Today we will start applying all of the machinery that we developed to quantum field theory on an expanding space-time. Remember how the machinery works. We need to solve the quantum field theory. We need to find the field phi hat of x and t. And the answers that will always succeed is that phi hat of x and t is the sum over some labels k that don't have to be momenta, but will be in our case now. Some labels k, and then we have so-called mode functions and the a and a dagger operators, and a and a dagger operators that obey the usual commutation relations, and then the Hermitian conjugate. That ensures that the hermeticity condition is fulfilled right away. And if these are chosen to be solutions to the classical Klein-Gordon equation, then the whole thing will be a solution to the quantum Klein-Gordon equation. And in order for the commutation relations to hold between phi and pi, we need that these mode functions obey a certain condition, the so-called Wronskian condition. So in order for the a dagger commutation relations to translate into the proper phi pi commutation relations, we need actually infinitely many of those mode functions, because the Wronskian condition, this one down here, cannot be obeyed with finitely many solutions. You see, if it was just for the hermeticity condition and the hermeticity condition and the equations of motion, then one mode function alone would survive, would suffice. We would not need to have a sum at all. But the Wronskian condition, if you remember, has on the right-hand side a distribution, the Dirac delta. And on the left-hand side, it has this sum over these mode functions and their derivatives. Mode functions are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. They're going to be regular analytic functions. If you just take one of them, this combination is never going to be a Dirac delta. If you take finitely many of them, you're still not going to get a distribution. You need infinitely many of them. So it is actually the imposition of the canonical commutation relations that enforces the whole non-triviality of all of it, that we need infinitely many solutions. This sum needs to run over an infinite number of index values in order to solve the problem. But then, assume we've done that. Assume for a moment we found such a bunch of mode functions, u index k, such that the Wronskian condition is obeyed and such that there are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we can build a Hilbert space. And we start by defining an operator that we call zero, the zero ket, which is defined to be the vector that is annihilated, that is mapped to zero by all of the annihilation operators. It's of course only unique up to a phase, but that doesn't matter. Once we have this vector, we can then generate lots of other vectors by applying powers of a dagger of the various index values onto that vector. And in this way, we generate an orthonormal basis. These are normalization prefactors. And that basis spans our Hilbert space. It is the eigenbasis of the number operator, where a number operator is a dagger k, ak. It's the joint eigen, the Fock basis that we obtain here is the joint eigenbasis of all the number operators of all the harmonic oscillators. I mean, sorry, I shouldn't say harmonic oscillators, of all of the a dagger k, ak. However, if you remember, that machine works a little bit too well because there are many ways to do this. There are many sets of functions uk that obey these conditions. It seems difficult to find a set of functions uk such that they obey this Wronskian condition, but it turns out, as we saw from working with Dabou's theorem, that not only does there such a solution exist, but once we have one, we can generate a lot of others by certain maps. There are generally infinitely many solutions to this problem. There are infinitely many sets of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation UK that we can plug in there and solve that equation and therefore solve the quantum field theory. And when we do that, if we choose a different set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that the Wronskian condition is fulfilled, then we can also write our quantum field phi hat of x and t in this way. And so we get the same field, but it's expressed very differently now. Different mode functions, different A and A dagger operators. So let's put a tilde on these other mode functions and a tilde on these A and A dagger operators. In principle, this choice is no better or worse than that choice. So let's consider what we obtain when we worked with an alternative choice. Then again, we can define a vector 0 tilde as the vector that's annihilated by all of the A operators. And then we can apply A dagger tildes to arbitrary powers on our 0 tilde vector and span a Fock basis of the Hilbert space. This is going to give us a new basis for the old Hilbert space. It's also an orthonormal basis. But from the Stone-Fort-Neumann theorem, we know it's the same Hilbert space. Strictly speaking, we are assuming here that we have only a finite number of degrees of freedom. We actually have infinitely many, in fact, uncountably infinitely many. But if we apply an infrared cutoff, we get countably many. If we apply an infrared cutoff, we get finitely many degrees of freedom. And then the Stone-Fort-Neumann theorem applies. So as long as it is physically justified to confine our system to finite size, so we have an infrared cutoff, and it is also justified to cut off very, very short wavelengths at some point, like 10 to the minus 35 meters, the Planck length, then we can reduce the quantum field theory without penalty to a finite number of degrees of freedom, in which case the Stone-Fort-Neumann theorem applies, and we know that we are dealing with the same Hilbert space here. We have a unique representation, a unique solution of the quantum field theory. So we are assuming this. We are assuming that it is physically justified to impose an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, and that the removal will not introduce anything fancy. You should always keep that in mind that there might be exceptions, such as so-called quantum phase, so-called phase transition.
Since the universe is expanding very quickly, since we have an event horizon, not an event horizon, observable horizon, does that kind of count as a cutoff for us?
Not really. Not automatically. It does justify it physically. If you have a horizon, then you can say, well, okay, it's not accessible to me what is beyond it. And therefore, I can definitely choose a box that's larger than that. And I know, for physical reasons, that whatever boundary conditions I impose there cannot affect what I'm doing here at all. So it helps justifying the infrared cutoff. But it's not on its own solving the problem. Okay, so now we have seen that we have seen two choices of solving the quantum field theory. We get the phi hat of x and t either way, but we get different representations of it. And we get two different bases in the Hilbert space of states of the quantum field theory. And of course, there are not just two, right? There are infinitely many of those. Now, let us apply that machinery to Friedmann, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître spacetimes. First of all, remember that we had the Klein-Gordon equation for the field phi hat of x and t, and the Klein-Gordon equation had a friction type term in it. And so for convenience, we remove that friction type term by changing to a new variable. Remember, the new variable is the scale factor times the old variable. That's a very simple change. Definitely, if we can find that operator valued field, then we get the physical field phi hat very easily from that by just dividing by A of eta. Remember that there's a subtlety here, which is that since A of eta is growing, and especially in the very early universe, it's growing dramatically, we see that these two fields differ by a factor that's just number valued, but that number is growing dramatically. So that's something that we will get back to. It will mean in particular that if the chi field was to grow very fast, it doesn't mean that the phi field does. Because in order to get to the phi field, we still have to divide by the scale factor. Then we establish that in terms of the new field variable, chi hat, the Klein-Gordon equation takes this form, which does not have a friction term anymore, a friction type term. There's only a second derivative with respect to the conformal time. Remember, the primes denote derivatives with respect to conformal time. Dots denote derivatives with respect to cosmic time. So we have here second time derivatives, no first time derivatives, second space derivatives, as we would have in Minkowski space as well. And then we have this time-dependent effective mass term multiplying chi. So by using three tricks, we arrived at this Klein-Gordon equation for curved space-time. The Klein-Gordon equation would be really complicated if we formulated it in cosmic time with proper distances and directly expressed in terms of the field variable phi. There would be friction terms, mixer terms of all kinds. But by choosing conformal time instead of proper time, instead of cosmic time, and by choosing co-moving positions, a co-moving coordinate system, by choosing a coordinate system that grows along with the universe, and by adopting a new variable that's a rescaled version of the old variable, we arrived at that simplified version of the Klein-Gordon equation. And it's really very much simplified, because if it wasn't for these terms, this would be exactly the Klein-Gordon equation for Minkowski space, right? Second time derivative, Laplacian, and a mass term. It only differs from Minkowski space by the fact that the mass term has now a time dependence, and there's an extra term that doesn't even have anything to do with the mass. In fact, later on, we will find out that we don't need to worry about the mass term. It will enter in a different way. We can, for these purposes, we can neglect the mass term. And then we have here an effective mass term, this thing here. So all of the non-triviality of the expansion of space-time will enter the quantum field theory just through this term. And if we have a mass, also through that term. And what we already see is that there's a time dependence in there. So it is as if we had harmonic oscillators with a time-dependent mass term. So we have parametrically driven harmonic oscillator. We have harmonic oscillators that have parameters that can change over time. As it stands, though, it's not yet decoupled harmonic oscillators, because we have here still space derivatives. So it's still a partial differential equation. Let us turn it into a set of ordinary differential equations in the usual way, namely by Fourier transforming in space. See, if we hadn't used a co-moving coordinate system, that term would have been much more complicated, and we could not get rid of the derivatives by a mere Fourier transform. But because we chose a co-growing coordinate system, that's the only place in which the space derivatives occur. And so we can just do a Fourier transform now to go from covariant, from co-moving coordinates to co-moving momenta. And then that will decouple the differential equation. So it's all based on the simple observation that these derivatives that are in the Laplacian become multiplication operators, I times ki. When we do a spatial Fourier transform, and we call the spatial momenta ki. But this will be co-moving momentum. So we do the Fourier transform. We start with our field variable chi of eta and x. And then we do the Fourier transform, e to the power I kx. This is the usual Fourier transform factor. There's actually an h bar in here, but we are using units such as h bar is 1, so it doesn't show up. And then the Fourier transformed variable is usually indicated in this way, chi hat k eta with the k as a subscript. Logically, it should be in here with the eta. But for some reason, the community has chosen to make the momentum variable a subscript. But it's really just a momentum variable. And the inverse Fourier transform is, of course, exactly the same map, except that this minus becomes a plus over here. And the same Fourier transform applies to the canonically conjugate momentum field, pi, superscript chi. Remember, we always need to put a superscript here on the canonically conjugate momentum field because phi has its canonically conjugate momentum field, and chi also has one, and they are not the same. OK, so we have Fourier transformed the field and its conjugate. And then after the Fourier transform, the term minus Laplacian has become plus k squared. So now we have just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. Because for every value of k, for every point in momentum space, I should say for every point in co-moving momentum space, for every value of k, for every 3 vector k, we have simply the equation of a harmonic oscillator. Right? So second time derivative, and then we have something that indicates the slope of the harmonic oscillator, and then we have the phi, the chi k. It's a harmonic oscillator whose frequency depends on eta. Also notice that not every co-moving mode obeys the same equation. Right? The equation of motion depends on which co-moving mode we are looking at. For example, if we are considering a co-moving mode with a very, very large k, with a very large co-moving momentum k, which means a very short wavelength, then this term will dominate in here. Because whatever these values are, for large enough k, for sufficiently small wavelengths, this term will dominate. And therefore, we can already tell that the wavelengths that are super small, where the wave vector is super large, behave exactly like a massless field on Minkowski space. Because if this term dominates over these, so if we just slash them and say they don't matter, then we see that it's just exactly the Klein-Gordon equation for a massless field in Minkowski space. Right? Second time derivative, and then you have k squared, and then nothing, and then the field. However, it's a dynamical situation. If you take a particular value of k at some point in time, you say, I want to choose this k so large that it dominates over these terms, so that I'm definitely in the regime of Minkowski space, that these waves don't see that space-time is expanding. They don't see any space-time curvature. It's just like Minkowski space. If you do that at some point in time, then yeah, you can. You can always find a k that's larger than this. But it won't last forever, because these things are time-dependent. And at some point, they can catch up with your k. Right? Because, I mean, if you fixed your k, right, no matter how large you fixed it, at some point they can catch up with it and they can start becoming more important than that term. Even this one with the negative one might become more important than that one. And then, as we discussed, you know, the potential can go this way. And what does that mean? You see, a co-moving momentum means A large comoving momentum means a small wavelength. But how small depends on time. Because a comoving momentum is a momentum, or is a wavelength, that grows with time. Remember that our position coordinates are growing with the coordinate system. Therefore, also the wavelength that we talk about in our coordinate system grow with the time. They grow with the expansion of the universe. So our coordinate system grows, our co-moving momenta mean larger and larger wavelengths. The same value of k, the same wave vector k, means different wavelengths at different physical wavelengths at different times. So if you choose a really large k at some point in time, and you're looking at a wave of small wavelength, but over time, that wavelength gets stretched. It's still the same value of k, right? But it gets stretched. So the physical wavelength gets larger and larger. And so eventually, the wavelength is so large that the wavelength starts caring about the fact that the universe is curved, that it has expansion, and so on. I mean, when I speak of curvature, I mean expansion. Remember that expansion of space-time is curvature between space and time. Between space and space directions, we assume no curvature. All right, and then of course there could be modes. You can consider a mode whose k is small right from the beginning, where these terms dominate over that, for example. Okay, so overall we have a harmonic oscillator equation for every k. But for every k, it's a different kind of harmonic oscillator. The potential has a different slope. And we can put it this way. We can write this as an omega k squared. We can write this as the frequency squared. So then our Klein-Gordon equation becomes this equation, just a harmonic oscillator for each value of k, where the frequency is this square root. And clearly, if this term, in circumstances where this term is dominant over the others, the discriminant becomes negative and the frequency becomes imaginary, and the plane wave solutions, e to the power I omega t, become growing and decaying solutions. Instead of having a counterclockwise and clockwise rotations in the complex plane, when you get an extra I up there in the exponent, then you have exponential growth and exponential decay. So while the usual harmonic oscillator has one complex solution that rotates counterclockwise and one that rotates clockwise in the complex plane, when this term dominates, then we have a basis of solutions consisting of one exponentially growing and one exponentially decaying solution, whatever that means. Remember, the exponentially growing solution doesn't mean that physically the field blows up, because it's the chi field that blows up, which is not the physical field. The phi field is the chi field divided by the scale factor. And so we may have exponential increase here of the amplitude because of this sign reversal in the discriminant. But we can also expect that the scale factor might have an exponential behavior. And that could just make sure that the phi field, the physical field, doesn't explode. And that's actually what will come up. We will find that the chi field grows exponentially under certain circumstances. But these are circumstances where the expansion of the universe is exponential, or almost exponential. And the two things will just counteract each other, such that the physical field just freezes in its amplitude. Doesn't grow, doesn't shrink in its amplitude. But of course, the decaying mode decays very quickly. All right, just anticipating this, we will see in all detail. All right, so here are the extreme cases. The frequency omega k may become imaginary, namely if the A double prime term is large enough, because the A double prime term is what we have here. And if that happens, I mean, that happens if the expansion is rapid enough. And what is rapid enough, we will calculate exactly. But of course, the discriminant also depends on the value of k, so there's an interplay. Even if the universe is expanding very, very fast, or the rate of expansion is accelerating, it doesn't mean that the discriminant is negative for all modes. You can always find a k which is large enough. You can always find a k which is large enough to dominate over that. Right? So even if the universe is going extremely fast at the very beginning, for sufficiently short wavelengths, for sufficiently large k, everything is still in order. And the wave thinks, well, nothing special happening. The physics of that will turn out to be the physics of the comparison of two lengths. The wavelength of our mode, when we translate the co-moving wavelength into a proper wavelength, that length needs to be compared with the size of the so-called Hubble horizon. When the universe is expanding in an accelerated way, then there will be a horizon. There will be a certain distance beyond which you can no longer communicate. Because if you wanted to communicate, for example, by sending light, then the light would never receive, it would never arrive at the receiver. Because even though the light is traveling at the speed of light, as the light crosses distances, more space is being created per unit time between you and the intended recipient than light can cross in that amount of time. So there is a horizon in accelerated universes. And all those waves, all those wavelengths that are shorter than that horizon size, still have a positive discriminant. That's the ones where k squared is larger than that, and everything is still fine. It looks like Minkowski space to them. But the waves whose wavelength is larger than that horizon over which you can communicate, those waves will have this negative discriminant where this term dominates. And then what we will find is that their wave, their amplitude freezes. It's a very curious phenomenon that I'd like to see a classical analog of, because it's actually classical mathematics that says that. If you take any medium that supports waves, it could, for example, be a trampoline, and you expand it in an accelerated way so that it acquires a horizon, so that the expansion rate exceeds the speed with which communication can be done over that medium from a certain distance onwards, then just the classical wave equations predict that all wavelengths larger than that horizon freeze. These waves stop oscillating. Just don't oscillate. Just whatever the amplitude is, that's what they will keep. So that comes up in cosmology, and then the quantum theory of that will be that quantum fluctuations that normally are important only at small wavelengths will freeze, and as the universe expands dramatically, these quantum fluctuations that used to be of small wavelengths become of very large wavelengths because of the expansion, but the amplitude remains the same. That's important because quantum fluctuations are usually of tiny amplitude if they have a large wavelength, and they have a large amplitude at small wavelength. But because of this phenomenon, large amplitude, small wavelength quantum fluctuations can have their amplitude frozen and their wavelength stretched to cosmological size. All right, then there are a few little things that we will use, technical things, when we now apply the machinery of quantum field theory to that situation. One is that when we Fourier transform our chi field, then take the Hermitian conjugate of it, then we obtain the chi field at minus k. You may remember seeing something like that before. It's simply the quantum field version of the statement that when you take a real valued function and you Fourier transform it, then the Fourier transform is no longer a real valued function. But it's not a completely arbitrary complex function either. The Fourier transform of a real-valued function is a function that has the property that its complex conjugate is the same as if you take the function at minus of its argument, right? So if this was a complex-valued function, I mean, if this was the Fourier transform of a real-valued function, instead of being the Fourier transform of a Hermitian-valued function, then you would have here the complex conjugation, and then it would simply say that chi complex conjugated at k is the same as chi at minus k. It's just a very simple property of Fourier transform. And the same is true for the canonically conjugate momentum field. And then I leave it also as an exercise to you to show that the canonical commutation relations between chi and its canonically conjugate momentum field in momentum space are like this, with an I Dirac delta of k plus k prime. And the chi and the pi commutators are these. If you take the canonical commutator between chi and the pi dagger, then they are just these. It's just a simple exercise of Fourier transform. It's easy to overlook, easy to make a mistake if you think that after Fourier transform, the canonical commutation relations remain the same. They don't. They get a little bit changed into this. Okay, so now in order to solve the three conditions for our quantum field theory, namely the equation of motion, the hermeticity condition, and the canonical commutation relations for our field chi k, now in momentum space, this is the ansatz that we will make. Or this is what our usual ansatz translates into, namely that the chi k of eta is this linear combination. And notice something subtle here, which is that now we have here the mode function of minus k and a of minus k. Just a sec. I think there's somebody. OK. So this is no longer the Hermitian conjugate of that. But this is necessary in order to fulfill the hermeticity condition now, because remember that after the Fourier transform, we must have that chi dagger is no longer chi. No, chi dagger is chi with a minus k in here. So in order to ensure this after the Fourier transform, we have to make the ansatz like that. Everything else is still the same. These guys have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in momentum space. And of course, there's the Wronskian condition. So the proposition is that this ansatz here solves the hermeticity condition by construction. It also solves the equation of motion, namely simply by virtue of these two functions being solutions to the classical Klein-Gordon equation, I mean to the number-valued Klein-Gordon equation. And remember, the number-valued Klein-Gordon equation is this. So our mode functions have to obey this condition here. This was just omega squared. And thirdly, we need the canonical commutation relations to hold. And the canonical commutation relations now translate into a Wronskian condition. But very beautifully, luckily for us, the Wronskian condition now simplifies a lot. Remember, the Wronskian condition had this tremendous sum in it, sum over all k and so on. It looked like that because the underlying differential equation was a partial differential equation. Now that we have disentangled those degrees of freedom, now that we have Fourier transform, and we arrived at the Klein-Gordon equation for each mode separately, we have separated this huge Wronskian condition into infinitely many simple Wronskian conditions. And now we have one Wronskian condition for each k. So for each value of the three momentum, the co-moving three momentum k, our solutions need to obey this condition here. And that's not difficult to prove. You can prove that from scratch. You could use our general results and specialize them. But you can also just reprove that from scratch. How do you do that? Remember? You take this ansatz, and then you say, OK, the A and the A dagger obey the usual commutation relations. What condition do these have to obey such that chi and its canonical conjugate obey the required canonical commutation relations? And the answer to that is that these mode functions have to obey this simple condition, this one here. Okay, much easier now. So equation W is the Wronskian condition. Now, let's assume, let me just highlight a little exercise there. Let's assume that we have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, Vk of eta. And we've chosen it cleverly. We've chosen it such that it's not only a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. No, it also solves the Wronskian condition, which, by the way, is a nonlinear condition. You see, if V solves the Wronskian condition, then 7 times V doesn't, because the 7 would be here and there and there and there, but not here. Right? So it's actually a normalization condition on your solutions. But how do we know that if the V solves the Klein-Gordon equation at one point, solves the canonical commutation relations condition, the Wronskian condition at one time, that it will obey it at all times? What you can do there is you can assume that it's true at one point in time and then calculate the derivative of it. Calculate the derivative of the left-hand side and see if the left-hand side changes. It shouldn't, because it should be 2i at all times. And you can prove that the Wronskian condition is conserved in time by, as I said, just differentiating this left-hand side. You get two terms here, one with a v double prime and a v, and one term with a v prime and v star prime. And here similarly, and then use the equation of motion, because V obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, and you find that the derivative of the left-hand side is actually 0, as it should be, and you have conservation. It's the kind of question that can come up in comprehensive exams and things like that. Okay, so. We have arrived at this situation. In order to obtain a solution to our quantum field theory, we find for every mode k, for every choice of co-moving mode vector or co-moving momentum vector, a solution vk of eta, that is to say a solution to the classical harmonic oscillator problem with a time-dependent frequency. So all of the non-triviality of the expansion of the space-time is compressed into the time dependence of the frequency of omega k. Then we need to make sure that our vk solution that we use here for the mode is properly normalized, that it obeys the Wronskian condition. And then once we've done that, so we've picked the solution vk to the time-dependent harmonic oscillator equation, and we have normalized it properly, then we can build us a basis of the Hilbert space. Now we can take our AK operators and consider the ket vector 0 that's annihilated by it, and then apply A dagger K multiple times and build a Fock basis for this particular momentum. Okay. And we can do that for all of the k's, and then the full Hilbert space is the tensor product of all those individual Hilbert spaces. By the way, one thing that is curious in this is that the Wronskian condition forces that we get, that we choose a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation which is complex valued. We cannot have a real valued one. See, in principle, the Klein-Gordon equation here has only real coefficients. That's real, that's real, that's real, real, real. So in principle, V double prime and V, I mean, it could all be real. For example, in Minkowski space, let's say if there was just a mass term or not even a mass term, then sine and cosine would do it, right? There are sine and cosine solutions. But the Wronskian condition forbids us from using them, even in Minkowski space. And the reason is that if V was a real valued function, a real valued solution to the harmonic oscillator, then, well, look at this. I mean, you see, this term is the same as that one if V is real. So we would just take the difference between a term and itself, and then that could not be 2i. So what we see here is that the mode functions always have to be complex valued. They always have to describe some rotation in a complex plane. Sine and cosine alone don't do it, even though the field is Hermitian valued. It's the quantization of a real valued field. For the mode functions, we always need that they are complex valued. OK, so let's assume we've done all of that. We've picked a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation for fixed k. And then we made sure that it obeys the Wronskian condition, which involved making sure that we didn't pick a real valued solution. So we picked a complex valued solution, something like some prefactor times the cosine plus I times some other prefactor times the sine, for example. And then we plug it into the Wronskian condition, and it will give a constraint on those prefactors, which we can solve, and then we have a solution. But as we discussed earlier, it's not unique. Our answer is a little bit too successful, it seems, because any such solution will do the trick. It just has to obey the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, and there are many such choices. So for example, we could choose one solution, vk, complex valued solution, vk of eta. Or we could choose another set of solutions, vk tilde of eta, both of which Wronskian normalized. Then we can span our Hilbert space either using this Hilbert basis or using that Hilbert basis. We get the same quantum field by Stone and von Neumann, but restart now. OK. We get this by Stone and von Neumann, we get the same Hilbert space, but a different Hilbert basis in it. Now, which choice should we make? It's the same physics. It's the same quantum field. It turns out we can choose whichever solution we want. We can describe all of the physics. But it can be convenient to choose a particular set of mode functions to make a particular choice for the VK. Namely, we will often find it convenient to choose our mode function in such a way that the Fock basis that comes with it is such that this vector has a particular significance, for example, being the vacuum state. And then at the later time, we may want to use a different basis in the Hilbert space, such that the vector 0 tilde is, for example, the vacuum state then. See, over time, which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum can change over time. And so during a period of time when a particular vector is the vacuum state, it is convenient to work with the mode functions that give us a vector 0, which coincides with what is the vacuum then. But later on, we may want to use different mode functions with different A and A dagger operators with tildes on them, with a vector 0 tilde, which coincides with what is the vacuum state then. And remember, that's not because, I mean, when I'm saying that the vacuum state is one Hilbert space vector early, and then it's another Hilbert space vector late, that's not because of the Schrödinger picture. We are working in the Heisenberg picture. The state is frozen. I'm just saying what the meaning is of a Hilbert space vector changes over time. And so what is the vacuum state at one time may not be the vacuum state at a later time. That has nothing to do with the Schrödinger evolution. This is just because the observables change, the meaning of states change. See, in the Heisenberg, it's totally normal in the Heisenberg picture. For example, let's say you study the evolution, the motion of a particle in the Heisenberg picture. So its position expectation value is moving, right? Now, in the Schrödinger picture, what you have is that the wave function changes where it has its peak. But what happens in the Heisenberg picture? In the Heisenberg picture, the wave function is frozen, right? The wave function is always here. Like if it's a Gaussian, it's always a Gaussian here, even though the particle is moving. So the wave function, the state is the same. But what it means changes over time, because the position operator changes. So actually, if you just calculate what the Schrödinger evolution is of a particle that's moving, in the Heisenberg picture, you find, well, the wave function is frozen to be, let's say, the early Gaussian. But the meaning of, the position operator itself now evolves in time. And that means that the meaning of that initial state vector changes over time. And so similarly, in the Heisenberg picture, what we have is that the vacuum state is not described by the same vector at all time. It changes. OK, so we will often find it convenient to work with at least two or even more of these solutions. So to work with different Hilbert bases in our, with different Fock bases in our Hilbert space. And of course, what will then be important is that we learn how to express these basis vectors in terms of those basis vectors and vice versa. So that in particular, if, for example, the system starts out in the vacuum state and we choose our mode function such that the corresponding vector 0 is that vacuum state, then the state of the system is always going to be this state. But then, let's say later on, after the universe has undergone a dramatic phase of expansion, it could be that a different vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum, this vector, with a corresponding mode function. And then, what does it mean? It means the system is in this state. That, later on, is the vacuum state. So at a late time, this is the state of the system, but that's the vacuum state. So then we can expand this state, the state of the system, as a linear combination in that Fock basis. And what we will find is that since this is not the same vector as that one, this is a linear combination of these guys, which means what used to be the vacuum state at a later time will be a state full of particles. So expansion can create particles, which is, of course, nothing really new. We know that from harmonic oscillators. We did that early on in the course. We showed that if you drive harmonic oscillators externally, you can create excitations. Here we do the same thing, except we don't drive these harmonic oscillators externally. Now they're parametrically driven with the omega k being time dependent instead of having a force on the right hand side that would be time dependent. So we get Bogoliubov transformations the same way we got them earlier. All right, I think I already said these things. In the Heisenberg picture, the system state vector is always the same Hilbert space vector. Yeah, that's by definition of the Heisenberg picture. But the observables evolve in time. Therefore, the meanings of all Hilbert space vectors changes over time. For example, as I said, if you look at the wave function of a Schrödinger particle that's moving through space, in a Schrödinger picture, the Gaussian is moving. In the Heisenberg picture, the Gaussian stays. Its interpretation is moving. OK, that's just this business of what was the vacuum early on may not be the vacuum state later on. So So how many possible choices are there for solving this Wronskian condition? How many choices vk, vk tilde, vk double tilde, etc. do exist? Now let's consider each mode k separately, because for each mode k we have a separate independent harmonic oscillator problem to solve. Let us look at how big the solution space is from which we can pick our v. Because remember, the v's have to solve the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition. Let's start with the Klein-Gödel equation. So we fix k, we consider a fixed co-moving mode, fixed co-moving wavelength, which of course over time means different physical wavelength. So we fix our k anyway, and we ask how many solutions are we going to have to that? Any guesses? How big is the solution space to that? There are infinitely many, but what's the dimension?
Infinitely many for each k.
Yes, for each k there are infinitely many solutions. But what's the dimension of the solution space? Any guesses? The second order differential equation. Yeah, two complex dimensions. Right? If we take a solution to this Klein-Gödel equation and multiply it with a complex number, then that complex number drops out if we plug it in here, right? If we assume vk of eta solves that equation, then 5 times it will also solve that equation, because the 5 will be here and will be there, and you can just cross it out. You can also take your solution vk and multiply it with I. The I as well will drop out. And you can multiply it with 5 plus I, will drop out, right? So for every solution you have, it will generate a one-dimensional space of solutions, right? But since it's a second-order ordinary differential equations, they're going to be two independent solutions. So the solution space is two complex dimensional, which is to say four real dimensional. Because you can multiply each of the two basis solutions by a real part, by a number with a real part and an imaginary part. So in principle, we have four real dimensions. So we have a four real dimensional solution space to pick from, which sounds like there is a four parameter family of candidates for the vacuum state, right? Because whenever we pick one of those vk, we are implicitly picking a set of operators ak and ak dagger, and then the ak generates a Fock space, because it generates the vector zero, and then with the a dagger k, we can generate all of those Hilbert space vectors that make up the Fock space. But it's not actually four real dimensions, it's only three. And the reason is that we also have to fulfill the Wronskian condition. So there are two complex dimensions for the solution space of the Klein-Gödel equation, but there's also the Wronskian condition. So if vk is a solution of the Klein-Gödel equation, then vk star is also a solution to it. And if it's not a real valued solution, that's an independent one. So any arbitrary solution of our Klein-Gödel equation can be written as a linear combination of a complex vk and its complex conjugate, with coefficients, linear combination coefficients, alpha k and beta k. So this is where the four real dimensions come in. Alpha can have has a real part and an imaginary part, and beta has a real part and an imaginary part, so we count four real dimensions. But the actual dimensionality of the space of possible mode functions is only three. And the reason is that the vk also have to obey this condition here. Now, it would seem that because this is a complex equation, it is actually an equation for the real part, an equation for the imaginary part. It would get rid of two parameters. But it doesn't. It only gets rid of one parameter, because the left-hand side is the imaginary part of this. Because you take this minus its complex conjugate. So all it says is that the imaginary part of this product is 2. So out of those 4 parameters, one of them goes away because of the Wronskian condition. So we have a 3-parameter family of possible mode functions that we can choose from. And it's not a 3-dimensional vector space. It's a 3-dimensional submanifold in a 4-dimensional space because it's not a linear condition, this one. Okay. So how are they related then to each other? Many choices, and there will be good reasons to sometimes make one choice and sometimes make another choice. For example, because the vacuum state at early times might be one Hilbert space vector, and the vacuum state at another time later on might be another Hilbert space vector. And then it is wise to choose the 2 mode functions, namely one mode function at early times, such that its corresponding vector 0 is the vacuum state at early times. And then at late times, we choose another mode function to create another basis, a Fock basis, whose 0 tilde vector is coinciding with what is the vacuum state then. So let's assume we are considering 2 of those. So let's say Vk is one of those legal mode functions obeying both the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition. Then let us consider a Vk tilde. Let us assume you now want to change to another one, to another solution. And we know that the other solution, Vk tilde, is a linear combination of the Vk and its complex conjugate. Remember, we know we can write it this way because Vk obeys the Wronskian condition, which ensures it is not real. Right? We discussed that V cannot be real. Vk cannot be real. If it were real, that would not be a legal way of writing things. Because if V was real, that would be V again, and then it would span only one-dimensional space. But it's not, and so this is actually spanning the 2-dimensional space. Anyway, so the Vk and its complex conjugate span the 2-dimensional vector space of solutions. 2 complex dimensional vector space of solutions. And therefore, there must exist coefficients alpha k and beta k such that whatever new solution we might want to use is a linear combination of the old solution and its canonically conjugate, Vk star, complex conjugate. All right. But the Vk tilde will also have to obey the Wronskian condition. This guarantees it's a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation because this and that are. But this is the condition, it turns out, for the coefficients alpha k and beta k to ensure that the new mode function also obeys the Wronskian condition. I leave it to you as a little exercise to prove this. So all you have to do is plug this expression for Vk tilde into the Wronskian condition and see what it means for the coefficients alpha and beta, knowing that the V already obeys the Wronskian condition. So what you find is that Vk tilde will be from the 3-dimensional solution space that obeys both the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition, if and only if the alpha and the beta obey this condition. And here again, we see that it's 3-dimensional, because this has a real part, imaginary part, a real part and imaginary part, and one equation relating them. So this is the equation that gives us the shape of that 3-dimensional submanifold of that 4-dimensional solution space of the Klein-Gödel equation. So in this way, we can easily generate from one solution that obeys the Wronskian condition, any number of other solutions that obey the Wronskian condition. We just pick a value for alpha, whatever you do, you want. You can choose 115 here. Then you will find a value for beta, in fact, many values of beta, such that this difference is 1. Then use those 2 values of alpha and beta, plug them in here, and you get another one, V tilde, and it will be a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition. So there's an easy method here to generate one solution from the other. And this is still the very simple case that we happen to find in cosmology, where each mode can be considered separately. In the case of black holes, or in much more general spacetimes, where some part might be growing faster than others, and so on, you can have much more complicated situations where you can mix between the modes. It would be as if we had a mixture between different values of k. But here, everything stays within one value of k, because we can still decouple everything into just an infinite number of ordinary differential equations. All right, so we get many different ways of writing our quantum field, namely in terms of the v mode function with its a and a dagger operators, or in terms of the v tilde with its a tilde and a tilde dagger operators. And these transformations are, again, examples of what are called Bogoliubov transformations that we encountered previously with external driving and so on. So whenever we have competing Fock bases, or just simultaneous Fock bases for the same Hilbert space, then going from one basis to the other is a Bogoliubov transformation. Either the name applies to either the transformations of the vectors or the operators. So we have two tasks now. We need to calculate those Bogoliubov coefficients explicitly when we have two of those Fock bases. And also we have to figure out which Fock bases we want to use. How do we identify which is the convenient choice? How do we identify which is the mode function? Which is the right choice of mode function such that the vector 0 annihilated by its A operator happens to be the vacuum state at a time that we might be caring about the vacuum state. Okay, so before we get into the physics of calculating which vector is the vacuum vector in expanding spacetime, let us look at more closely at this Bogoliubov transformation. So let's assume we've figured out how to choose mode functions wisely, and we've decided that before the universe undergoes a period of expansion, this choice of mode functions is convenient, and afterwards that other choice of mode function is convenient, and correspondingly we get one Fock basis and another Fock basis, then we may want to know how to transform from one into the other. And let's call them the tilted and the untilted Fock bases. So we know that the field can be expressed in one way or the other way. So let us look at equations B and P. Where are they? This is equation P. This is equation B. So what we have here is that the field, the physical field, is expressed either in terms of this choice of mode function and creation and annihilation operators, or that choice, the tilde choice. And we also have that the mode functions are related in this particular way. So if we plug this now into here, we can express all occurrences of V tilde here in terms of the V. And in this way, I mean, forget about the left-hand side, we just have that this is equal to that. We can plug that into here, and then we arrive at the relationship between the a dagger on one side, and the tilde a's, and the tilde a daggers on the other side. Remember, that's also what we needed to do for the externally driven harmonic oscillator at the beginning of the course. We needed to relate the a early with the a late, or a in to the a out. And so similarly here, we want to express the A and A dagger operators in terms of the A tildes and the A tilde dagger operators, because once we can do that, we can then work out how the Hilbert bases are related to each other. Okay, so the claim now is, and I leave it to you as a little exercise to prove it, that if you plug that in here and then compare coefficients for equal prefactor, namely the prefactor could either be V or V star, then you get the following relation between the A and the A tildes. You get this relationship. The AK are given by AK, alpha K star, and then here the A tildes and the A tilde dagger there. So that's the relationship between the annihilation operator of one choice and the annihilation and creation operators of the other choice. This is the key. From this, we can unlock how the two Hilbert bases are related to each other. And the reason is that, or the way we go about it, is very similarly to how we did it for the externally driven harmonic oscillator. Remember, the key condition that defines what the vector zero is for a given A is that A annihilates it. Now, let us express that equation by expressing the A in this way. So this equation is really also that equation here. So now it looks like, well, what can we do with this? We know how the A and A dagger act on that. But here we have those tilted things. How on earth are we going to find out how they act on this? You don't need to. What we want is we want to express this as a linear combination, right, of the tilted quantities, of the tilted Fock vectors. So what we do is we say, let us express the right-hand side now as it must be possible. Let us express this as a linear combination of the Fock bases, of the tilted Fock bases. Right? So the vector zero has to be some combination of tilted A and A dagger operators acting on the tilted vector zero. And how do we find out what combination it is? How do we find out how, what linear combination of Fock vectors, of tilted Fock vectors, the vector zero is?
Is there some particular reason why that's written as F sub k of A sub k sub minus k, rather than why is it a function of the two?
Well,
plus or minus k.
No, it just comes out this way. But okay. I mean, you could do that more generally. The way I want to do it is the mathematician's way, which is I give you the solution and then explain why it's right.
Okay.
Of course, if you want to do it the physicist's way, you would say, okay, how do you know that?
I'm really happy with
how do you derive this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the claim now is that this is the answer to that. So basically, I mean, the question is, what is this thing in terms as a linear combination of the Fock bases of the tilted Fock bases? And also, we are ambitious here, and we try to do it for all of the harmonic oscillators at once, for all k at once. That's why we get a product here, because the state, this state, is the tensor product of the corresponding state for each of the harmonic oscillators. So that is actually a tensor product here. And then these things are going to be sums of terms. And it turns out that it's only these combinations. I mean, you're summing over all k, so you don't have to organize them in this way with a k minus k. But it's just the way that it comes out. And we will soon see why that is. Ultimately, the physical reason for that is that when space-time produces particles through expansion, it produces them in pairs. Whenever it produces a particle that moves on in this direction, it also produces a particle that moves on in this direction. You can think of it this way, that space-time can produce particles, but it can't produce net momentum. So whenever there is a particle produced that moves with this momentum over there, it must produce a particle as well that moves with the same momentum the other way. You can think of it that there is actually a non-space-time analog of this. An effect that is called the Schwinger effect, and that we seem to be at the verge of experimentally verifying. The idea is this: take an electric field and make it super strong. Then there could be the generation of an electron-positron pair just because of the electric field. The vacuum is supposed to always fluctuate with electron and positron pairs. We didn't study QED here, but that's what you find. Electron-positron pairs, but they usually just get created and recollapse, created, recollapse. But if there's a sufficiently strong electric field, then a virtual electron-positron pair can become a real pair because the electric field is pulling one of the two of the electron-positron pair in one direction, the other one in the other direction. And if the electric field is strong enough, you should get a net effect of creating electron-positron pairs. It's just very difficult to create electric fields that are so strong.
Isn't that, though, the way that beta plus decay is supposed to work?
I don't think so. That's a weak interaction. Hmm? That would be the weak interaction. So it's actually the weak interaction that creates the electron. It wasn't there before.
Well, but okay.
But it doesn't create them in pairs either.
Well, so the idea is, so in beta plus decay, the idea is that I've read, this was like a Scientific American article, so take it with a large grain of salt, is that the electric field close to the nucleus, so in beta plus decay, right, you emit a positron, the electric field close to the nucleus is so strong that it essentially yanks an electron out of the vacuum, and then a positron goes off.
But it still needs the weak interaction.
I can't account for that part.
Yeah. Because otherwise, there would have to be an antiparticle as well that goes the other way. We can look into that. So gravity produces particles in pairs. If it produces particles, it does that in pairs. So here's what we get. And before we prove it, let's just have a quick look at what it does, how it looks like. So these are normalization factors here. And then here we have the tensor product over all k. Maybe I should have written this as a big tensor product sign. Let's look at 1k. So for one harmonic oscillator, what do we have for fixed k? We have e to the power of minus, and then some number here. It's just a complex number. And then we have a dagger tilde k, a tilde dagger a minus k applied to the zero tilde vector. What that means is that what is the vacuum state, or what is the vector zero with respect to one choice of mode function, and it might well in physical situation be the state that was the vacuum state early and still is the state of the system because we work in the Heisenberg picture, that state at a later time where this is the vacuum state would be a multiparticle state. And what kind of particle content would that state have? Well, lots of them. You would have a finite probability to finding a million particles. Namely, look at the term in the exponential. I mean, you should think of this as a power series. And then there's going to be a term in there where you have this to the power of 500,000, which means that you have a tilde dagger minus k acting 500,000 times on this, creating 500,000 particles moving in the minus k direction. And then that one acted also on that, producing 500,000 particles moving the other direction. So we have a million particles. The chance to see them is very low because this exponential has a 1 over n factorial as well. Now, not all of that is really suppressive. Some of it, the square root of it, is just the normalization of the state. But still, it's highly suppressed. like the square root of 1 over the factorial. So what we see here is that, in principle, this state is, in terms of that Fock basis, a state that has a little bit of a component in that direction. After all, this starts with a 1, this power series. But it has also all sorts of even numbers of particles around. I leave it to you to prove this. What do you need to do for that? You just have to apply this onto that and show that it's 0, where this is this. Okay? So you just need to apply this expression onto that. So you have to commute the a tilde k operator through that stuff. It's trivial to commute this through it because it's just dagger operators. But this one has a non-trivial commutator through that. And you just have to show that this equation then holds. And for that, if you want to prove this, you'll find it useful to use that equation here. That whenever you have A and A dagger operators obeying the usual commutation relations, then commuting A through that exponential, so if you put that on the left-hand side, you see it's just a commutator, then you get the derivative. I think we had that on the board at some point, that the A and A daggers commute exactly the same way that the derivative and the multiplication operator commute. And that's why when you have A commuting with a function of A dagger, then the commutator of A with a function of A dagger is f prime of that function of A dagger. So that's all you need to use, and then you can prove that this is the state. Then you still have to show the normalization, of course. But yeah, how do you prove the normalization? Well, you have to take this state as a ket and then as a bra, and then you have to commute operators to each other again because you have the A tilde k and a tilde minus k now on the left-hand side, and you have to commute them through. It's a little tedious, but that's what you get. All right, so all of this we already discussed, namely that this equation here tells us, in particular, how many particles would be created or have been created if this was the state of the system early on, and we chose it such that it was actually the vacuum state early on, and then if at a later state this vector is the vacuum state and we choose our mode function such that this is the vector that we get when we apply the A tilde, then this expression tells us how many particles have been created. Right, that's actually as far as we get today. Are there any questions? No? Keep in mind, there is something contained in there that we haven't addressed yet, which is that there can be a situation where we can't speak of particles because the harmonic oscillator goes like this. Right, then we don't have a Fock representation. So we will get into that later on. So far, we've assumed that the expansion is not so dramatic and that it's just some relatively harmless thing. We just have some time evolution, some particles get created, and so on. But actually, in cosmology, something more wild than that has happened. Well, then I wish you a nice weekend.